Welcome to For the Medical Record. I am Antoine Johnson.
And I'm Christy Slobogan.
Christy, great seeing you today.
You too.
And we had a wonderful conversation with a good friend and colleague. You want to share with the folks what we discussed today?
We talked to Jessica Lee Hester, who is currently a PhD student here in the History of Medicine department at Hopkins. And we talked to her about her book, which was published a couple of months ago in 2022, called Sewer. And we talked about how sewers fit into an understanding of public health and the medical humanities, how she came to this project, how it fits with doing historical work and doing journalistic work. And it was really just a wonderful conversation with Jessica.
Yes. Jessica, as Christy mentioned, is a second-year PhD student in the Department of the History of Medicine. Prior to joining Hopkins, she received her bachelor's in English and Gender Studies from the University of Chicago and an MFA in nonfiction writing from Hunter College. A professional journalist mainly focused on science, her work has appeared in The Atlantic, New Yorker, New York Times Magazine, Atlas Obscura, and Bloomsbury published her first book, Sewer, in 2022. Jessica's research interests include the classed, gendered, and racialized dimensions of grave robbing, medical education, and the exhibition of human remains in 19th century America. She is interested in the long afterlives of medical collections, including displaying, interpreting, and deaccessioning or returning medical specimens from the mid-1800s to the present day.
Yeah. So in this episode, we talk about both of those groups of interests. So the PhD work, grave robbing and collecting of human specimens, and sewer stewardship, which you will hear us stumble over saying a couple of times because it's an incredibly difficult phrase to say.
Do you want to say it three times fast while we're recording?
Steward. Nope. See, I even messed up the first time. Anyway, thank you so much for listening to For the Medical Record, and I hope you enjoy our conversation with Jessica Lee Hester.
See you on the other side.
Okay, Antoine, you want to start it and lead us into the first question and get going?
Sweet. Okay, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. So, Jessica, thank you for joining us again. It's been a pleasure, first and foremost, working with you here in the Department of History of Medicine and the Center for Medical Humanities and Social Medicine. But speaking of which, you know, you are a PhD.
You better PhD do it.
I like that. Okay, rewind. 3, 2, 1. Speaking of which, you are a PhD student in the history of medicine, but we asked you on the podcast, on the show, you know, if you could talk about a book of yours that was published a few months ago, which is not based on your PhD research. Could you tell us how you got to this program and what you did in your working life before becoming a PhD student at Johns Hopkins?
Hi. Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Yeah, so I am in my second year in the program now, and I always knew that I hoped to be an academic in the future, but it took a little bit of a winding path to get here. So I did an MFA in narrative nonfiction at Hunter in New York, and during that, and well, even still today, I've been working as a journalist for over a decade. So I've written for newspapers and magazines before the book, and sort of alongside of that, worked and interned in various capacities in museums and curatorial, educational, and visitor services roles. I think the most immediate catalyst for wanting to come to this program now was sparked by just moments of exhilarating but utterly overwhelming fear in the archives. So for this book, I had a chance to go to the London Metropolitan Archives, which is a wonderful place that houses pretty amazing collections. And I got to look at some of the mid-19th century sewer status reports. So it was so easy to fall down into this rabbit hole or like maintenance hole of these incredibly dedicated people who filled notebook after notebook with sketches of the extent of clogs and various pipes, which actually were beautiful, kind of like pointillist paintings, you know, speckled with poop But anyway, so I spent days in the archives and just became totally obsessed with the number of different ways in to the questions that I had. And I could see, you know, how someone could spend months or years rifling through all of these papers, putting them in different orders, trying to approach them with different methods, and asking different questions of them. So I did not have months or years. I had like a week or something in London. And I left that experience thinking, I learned so much, but I don't know if what I learned was the most. Yeah, I guess I left thinking, I don't know if this was the most appropriate way to use these sources, if I could have learned something, you know, different by approaching it in a different way. Like, of course, I could have. But I guess I really wanted help at that moment, thinking about how do I ask a question that's like appropriately capacious, but also constrained enough to be feasible and meaningful? How do you know when you've done enough research? And then how do you corral everything you've got? And so that's when I sort of felt, okay, I need the tools that a PhD program can help me build immediately. So I was very, very grateful to get in when I did, because for the first year of the program, I was finishing the book. So I definitely think that the first year of the program has sort of imprinted on the book. So yeah, I hope going forward, I want to build a career as both an academic and a journalist, and I'm grateful to have both skill sets.
That's great. So that's kind of how you got to deciding that you need to do a history of medicine PhD. And also, so the book that we're talking about is called Sewer. So that's why it's relevant that you were looking at these sewer archives, right? But why did you start looking at those in the first place? Like, what got you interested in looking at the gross things under our feet?
I think I should preface this by saying it's not that I deny that sewers are gross. Like, very clearly they are gross. But I don't actually think it was the grossness that endeared them to me. So the origin of the book was this project at Atlas Obscura, where I was an editor for several years, where we decided to do a March Madness bracket about mundane objects, which wasn't as surprising as it sounded. This is very much like catnip for the Atlas Obscura reader. So I had the pleasure for many years of sitting next to this journalist named Eric Grundhauser, who had done this really fun story about the like transformative marvel of the bread clip. And I had read that story. Our readers were obsessed with the story. I think it was one of the top performing articles on the site of all time. And, you know, it was just about the little plastic thing that keeps bags of bread from going stale immediately. And we were talking about that and thinking, surely there are other inventions that have transformed people's experience of being alive on this planet. And we wanted readers to help us brainstorm how we might rank them in a needlessly contentious way. So I had the unfortunate responsibility of making the bracket. And I solicited feedback from readers, seeded the bracket in ways that readers hated. but the ultimate finalists at the end for these mundane inventions were sewer and paper. And like, I stand behind both of those. I think ultimately they're both defensible positions. But I had readers write in and sort of give us their case for one or the other. And I would publish like debates on the site and like rebuttals to each other's votes. And in the end, even some librarians who voted wrote in saying, you know, obviously sewer. You know, we love books, but wastewater infrastructure has changed the world and kept us alive. And I had never really thought about sewers as the transformative inventions that they clearly are. And that propelled me to start reporting a lot on sewers. There were a lot of fatbergs happening around the world in 2018. Unfortunately, those numbers have only grown. Those are, you know, matted masses of wet wipes, congealed fats, oils, and grease, trash, any other manner of unwelcome interlocutors in the sewer. And so as I kept reporting on that stuff, I just thought, I think that there's a book here. But it started with a competitive March Madness bracket.
I love that.
Same.
And thank you for defining fatbergs.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And very briefly, you know, your book is part of the Object Lessons series at Bloomsbury Publishing. Could you explain to us what that is?
Yeah, Object Lessons is a Bloomsbury series that focuses very much on, I think the tagline is something like the hidden lives of everyday things. So the whole series is very grounded in, obviously, objects, but people can approach it from very different perspectives, using different kinds of analytical tools and different genres of writing. So people have written about everything from dust to hoods to the driver's license. And I think some are in poetry form, some are essays. It really varies a lot. So that ended up being a really great home for a book like this, I think. I really liked thinking about infrastructure as an object. So I was really glad that it found a place there.
There are a couple of other books in the series that I really want to read. Like the one on the hood has been on my list for a really long time. And the one on the TV, I think they all, yeah, a lot of them look really, really fascinating. But so I guess listeners might be kind of wondering. They're like, okay, sewers, really cool topic. Book came out. Can see why you got her on the podcast. She's a history of medicine PhD student. All makes sense, but we are a medical humanities and social medicine podcast, and I can see why sewers might not automatically click with listeners as to fitting into those categories. But yet we asked you to be a guest for good reasons, I promise. So can you tell our listeners how and why sewers are objects that have a strong relation to and impact on medicine and health? Like, why did we ask you on?
I hope you don't regret it. So I think there are several ways in which sewers relate to public health. So in the History of Medicine survey, we try to make a case for this by introducing students to the delightfully named Great Stink of London, which was a period in the late 1850s when the city famously reeked because there was so much sewage stewing in the Thames in this hot summer. So that was a period right before the massive overhaul of London's sewage infrastructure that I talk about in the book. And, you know, at that point, the miasma theory of disease was still very potent. And so this was construed as being absolutely fearsome in addition to being gross.
Can you explain what the miasma theory is really quickly?
Oh, yes. So yeah, this was a period when the miasma theory of disease was very potent. That was the idea that illness was caused by drifting clouds that were making people ill. And we also try to tell the students in the survey, this wasn't foolish. Like, it wasn't that people were necessarily becoming sick as an immediate consequence of the smell itself. But being in such close proximity to entirely untreated sewage is often very dangerous. We also teach them about cholera, right? Which is the, you know, contemporaneous problem of fecal matter contaminating drinking water. So I think it doesn't necessarily take a lot to convince people that sewers as objects in the past had a very transformative impact on public health. You know, we did see huge plummeting in the amount of people dying of cholera when wastewater infrastructure was overhauled. But I think sometimes it might require a little more nimble thinking to understand sewers as medical objects in the present, although I think there are several ways in which they are. So in our present moment, I think sewers are a fascinating barometer of public health, especially when it comes to gauging the spread of COVID. So wastewater epidemiology, which is the study of disease in wastewater, is not new. It's been around for a few decades, but it has definitely become more widely embraced during the pandemic. I think especially as above ground testing infrastructure has become less robust, and as some people have had asymptomatic infections and didn't think to test in the first place, you're going to be using the toilet anyway. So that data is sort of there to be mined. By sampling sewage, scientists have been able to estimate the prevalence of COVID in a particular community and also pinpoint specific variants, which has been really advantageous for tracking the spread. I think another way that we can think about sewage as a medical object in the 21st century is thinking about the way that our medicalized bodies change ecosystems through the wastewater that funnels into them. So things like MRI contrast and chemical signatures of prescription drugs are often small enough to escape being captured at wastewater treatment facilities. And so they end up turning up in waterways and inside the bodies of the creatures that live there. So in the book, I write about research on, for instance, populations of native mussels in various streams in Canada that have pretty high concentrations of antidepressants in their bodies, just because the water is constantly filtering through them and carrying antidepressants inside.
That is wild. That's a really great answer, though. I really appreciate it. Because I remember first hearing about wastewater epidemiology when, I guess it was kind of early days, not super early days of COVID, but, you know, a couple of months into it, maybe. Is that right? And I just had no idea that that was possible. I mean, it makes total sense, but the idea that disease was being found in wastewater treatment centers totally blew my mind. So I appreciate you bringing that up.
Yeah, it totally blew my mind too. And one thing that I hope we can kind of carry forward is the broader application of these technologies. So I had no idea for a long time that wastewater epidemiology can be useful for tracking things like flu and hepatitis and use of opioids, and all of these other things that clearly also have a big impact on public health and can be difficult to gauge for many reasons. So I hope that this pandemic moment has maybe assuaged some people's fears that I think have curtailed the progress of wastewater epidemiology in the US in the past, largely involving privacy concerns. And I think we've seen in the COVID pandemic that, you know, wastewater epidemiology does not track sample back to person whose digestive tract produced the sample. And, you know, it gives us a population level snapshot. And so I hope going forward, there's more public funding for wastewater epidemiology, more digital support for the publicly facing testing dashboards like COVID Poops 19, which is an incredible global resource. So we'll see. I'm optimistic about it.
Have you actually been to a wastewater site yet?
I have. I've been to several sewers, both sewers in progress and sewers from which crews were busily extracting fatbergs. I have toured many facilities via Zoom because I did a lot of these reporting trips during the pandemic. So I focus on Newtown Creek, a facility in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, a lot in the book. And I took a romantic Valentine's Day Zoom tour of it with my partner, who was a really good sport about it all. But I actually have not yet been inside that facility. But I have been in a sewer, next to a sewer, in a flushability lab in Toronto where scientists track. They basically built a makeshift sewer line and flush products down a toilet in the lab and calculate how long it takes things to start to fall apart as a proxy for assessing whether something is actually as flushable as it claims to be, which it rarely is. So I did get a chance to see those in person, as well as a facility in Portland, Maine, that transforms cooking oil that would otherwise be flushed down the sink, I guess not flushed, just poured down the sink, into biodiesel for cars, ferries, local buses, and I think also snowplows. So yes, I got to see a lot of things in person, and I hope to keep going to these facilities because they're all amazing.
Nice. Thank you so much.
Oh, and one of my dreams, sorry. One of my dreams is to go to the EPA's National Sludge Repository, which is not as huge as one might think from that name. I believe it is a series of fridges at a school in Arizona where basically these samples that were collected in several national surveys a little over a decade ago, I think, are stored for potential future research. I may be a honeymoon destination. I don't know.
That's amazing.
Oh my goodness. Somehow this has to do with the Simpsons movie. Not sure if you've seen it, but it's about the EPA and environmental waste.
Doesn't it? I just remember EPA.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's all I remember from EPA. The Simpsons movie. You should watch it for research.
And write a review of the Simpsons movie. Contextualize it with your book.
Please tell my advisors that this is how I need to be spending my time.
I think it makes total sense. And I love that that was a Valentine's Day date. A couple years ago, went on a trip with four other couples to a medieval plague village on Valentine's Day. Oh, so I'm totally with you on that one.
So before the pandemic, the Valentine's Day tour used to be in person, and apparently they gave everyone Hershey's Kisses because they are the shape of the poop emoji. And I was incredibly jealous that we did not get to have any of them. But it's a great idea, brilliant marketing, and a really fun time.
I didn't realize that it was an actual like marketing tool. I thought that you just happened to go on Valentine's Day. Oh my God, that's incredible.
That is romantic. Now that you think about it.
I love it. So we'll talk a bit more about the book and your research on sewers. But, you know, as we said, you're also a PhD student here in the History of Medicine department. And we both have heard your work. We know your work here, and it's incredible. So we wanted to know, could you tell us a little bit about the work that you're doing for your PhD? And does the sewer work relate at all? How do you see them connecting, or how do you hold both of them in your head at the same time?
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about this, and I do think there's something to be said for having kind of different parts of your brain that you toggle between for different sorts of projects. So I do think, you know, in terms of time period and locations, the projects are very different. But I do see kind of a thematic and analytical overlap in some respects, particularly in an interest in networks and in the people who sustain them. So my work here at Hopkins focuses on grave robbing, specimen preparation, and general dissection education in 19th century America, specifically Philadelphia right now, but I'm probably going to broaden that out a little bit. And my sewer work has, you know, spanned the US and Canada, Europe, and briefly some other countries as well. But I think in all of those locations, a refrain I kept hearing was that the average person just seemed to expect sewers to keep functioning with very little upkeep or ongoing effort, when in fact, sewer crews work fairly consistently in a really laborious way to keep the pipes unclogged. And I think that pushed me to thinking about networks of grave robbing and specimen tracking as ones that were sustained by individual people's ongoing work. So I was very aware that bodies that were co-opted as cadavers, of course, did not just magically appear on dissecting room tables, and they were enmeshed in networks of power. So I think thinking about the sewer work as sort of this huge sprawling system that was maintained by the labor of individual people encouraged me to kind of trace the networks that I study in my academic work as clearly as I can. So I think methodologically and from a storytelling perspective, I really want to focus on the micro level and tell individual stories about what was at stake for all these different actors, which I think overlaps with the book, where I really wanted to tell human scale stories about being, you know, the custodians of these systems and got to follow individual people around. So in my dissertation, I hope to do both of those things, tell the story of shifting power networks by following individual actors in a really intimate way.
Thank you for that. And we sort of just like glossed over your dissertation research. I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit more on it. And additionally, what ties, if any, to contemporary concerns or debates do you see in your dissertation research on, you know, grave robbing?
Yeah. So I'm researching specific cemeteries that were routinely plundered by grave robbers in Philadelphia in the 19th century. And I think it's a really fascinating time to be doing this research because many institutions, including, you know, some in Philadelphia, are reckoning with the legacies of collections of human remains, many of which were stolen or purchased from other people who had stolen them. And so I think there are fascinating and crucial conversations about repatriation projects, debate over how to navigate them, and whose voices should be foregrounded in those conversations. So I'm currently coordinating a conference that will be taking place here at Hopkins next year about exactly this, remains in academic collections. And I hope that anyone listening who works on these topics will get in touch and come and join us.
Is there a link or a call for papers for that already?
No. I am going to be sending it out probably this weekend. So maybe by the time this is live, there will be.
That's perfect timing. This will come out at the end of April. So we will make sure that we've got that linked in our show notes so that anybody listening who's interested can see when it's happening, who might be there. I love your PhD work. I think it's really great. And the way that it intersects with, as you said, networks and, you know, individual people's stories, but also kind of the history of emotions and the history of collecting are two things that are near and dear to my heart. So yeah, I really appreciate that work. Sewers felt a little bit more outside of my usual wheelhouse, but I also enjoyed reading about that. Especially, I'm like, yeah, objects, that's material culture. I'm an art historian. This also, you know, vibes in some way. But anyway, so you've already talked really eloquently about how focusing on sewers relates to issues today around public health, particularly around COVID-19. And that's been really great to hear and be reminded that that's constantly working. And, you know, that there are people working, both as scientists and doing the upkeep of these sewers and pipes constantly to make sure that we don't have to think about it. So I really appreciate that. But one of the things that I really enjoyed reading in your conclusion was kind of how you have taken this work personally. And it's kind of changed how you interact with the world on a daily basis. You know, we're all interacting with plumbing and sewage and sewers literally every day, even if we don't think about it. And so one of the kind of calls to action in your conclusion is where you said that we can all think about sewer stewardship. Sewer stewardship is really hard to say, by the way, but how we can all think about sewer stewardship as an antidote for existential dread. And that really jumped out to me. So I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to that, how you see that in your everyday life, how you can see that applying to how we think about these problems of public health and sewer stewardship today. And yeah, what you meant by that, because I really appreciated that line.
Yeah, thank you. I think about it in terms of a really wonderful alternative to a lot of the other environmental problems that don't feel possible for me to make a dent in at an individual level. So I'm very concerned about climate change, droughts, fires, you know, really sprawling and intractable problems that require massive changes at the level of corporations and investments and federal funding. And as an individual person, I believe really strongly in aligning behaviors with values. So I don't eat meat. I try not to fly. I'm aware of my water use, but that doesn't build, it doesn't add up to the same kinds of changes that I think are really needed to address those problems in a meaningful way. Likewise, I don't think individuals' stewardship of the sewers should stand in for investment in these networks, which historically has been pretty dismal. But I do think that I personally feel that I can do more to prevent problems in the sewers than I can do to prevent or, you know, stem the tide of some of these other environmental problems. So learning about my specific neighborhoods and the way sewage functions there helped me make really small changes that potentially can help a lot. So I used to live in a town that had combined sewers, which is where stormwater and wastewater mingle. So when those pipes get overloaded, for instance, in a rainstorm, the mechanism that is built in is for the sewers to overflow with untreated wastewater going into, you know, rivers, streams, whatever body of water. And that is not a mechanism that the system engineers like, but it is a necessary one. And it's something that I, as an individual, can help avoid by doing things like not showering or running my dishwasher or doing laundry when it is raining, because all of those ways of introducing household water into an already overloaded system make it more likely that it will overflow. That's a really interesting and extremely minor thing, right, that I can do that will help protect ecosystems. Similarly, not dumping cooking oil down the drain requires like relatively little thought, right? It's not a big sacrifice to dump it into a jar instead of dumping it down the sink. And so I think it feels empowering in an admittedly limited way to think about just ways that I can avoid my footprint falling quite so heavily on the planet as I move through my day.
I just want to thank you for those small examples of how we can play our individual roles. Because I didn't know that, you know, about the whole, you know, not showering or running a dishwasher or doing laundry when it's storming outside, you know, and how that can, you know, be incremental progress, but progress nonetheless. So thank you for that.
Totally. And one thing that came up a lot when I was talking to people at the Newtown Creek facility in Brooklyn was sort of the lack of frequent education about the sewer system and how people can and should interact with it. So they have people who work in an education department there who bring school kids in to teach them about the wastewater treatment cycle and to sort of frame using this infrastructure as a civic responsibility. And I thought that was totally brilliant because, like you, I never had someone say, don't pour XYZ things down the drain. And how do you ever know that if people don't tell you what the consequences are? So I think it's so smart to introduce these topics to kids when they're young and still in school. Not that I mind now being the person that all my friends text with questions about whether they can dump particular things in the drain, which happens constantly, like several times a week. I just got a text the other day about whether coconut milk should go down the sink. And I don't have a definitive answer, but I think no. I'm leaning strongly towards no. But it would be great to learn this stuff as young as possible.
This is a totally kind of inchoate thought, but I'm vaguely remembering. So I used to live much closer to the coast. Well, I guess now in Baltimore I do again, but on the West Coast, and maybe you can speak to this too. But I remember there being more messaging because we were close to the ocean.
Yeah.
About this kind of thing, like what could go, you know, oh, you might hurt the seagulls, or which is a totally different kind of messaging versus the rest of the country, where it's like not, maybe not as visible, or maybe you think you're not as close to the ocean, so maybe it doesn't matter. But I remember that kind of being a thing, but it was all about hurting the animals, not about hurting the pipes or the drains.
Environment.
Yeah.
That is so interesting. I would love to look into that. I mean, one thing that I know is that microplastics, even in river areas, have been much less thoroughly studied than microplastics on coastal shorelines, although they appear in both landscapes. So I think there's definitely more messaging to be done in areas that are not like ocean coasts about the way that we are still changing ecosystems, right? Because me flushing something that ends up in a stream, you know, in Michigan is still affecting the lives of the animals that live there, even though they live in a lake or a river and not in an ocean. But I don't think you would necessarily know that as a kid growing up there. I did not know that as a kid growing up there. So I hope that there are more education campaigns in the future.
So back for your dissertation research and for your work on sewer stewardship, we're curious, you know, who are some of the, you know, scholars, writers, because of who your partner is, I'm going to throw in artists as well, and thinkers who have, you know, influenced your research the most. And who do you like to think, you know, alongside with?
Yeah, I think one thing I like a lot about both of these sorts of projects is that I think they invite interdisciplinary thinking. So with the sewer project, I thought a lot about nature writing, because I think there was a tendency when I would talk to friends about the project to assume that it was purely infrastructural, and, you know, heavily reliant on things like blueprints, which many wonderful books about the sewer are. But I really wanted to think about the sewer as an object that was, you know, kind of umbilically tethered to landscapes. And so I was really fascinated by Robert McFarlane's work about underground worlds and sort of the awe that they can stoke in people. So I read a lot of nature writing by him. And I think similarly in the academic world, I am finding it very nourishing and thought-provoking to read a lot of books that are very much grounded in sensory knowledge. So I really am poring over work by Pablo Gomez, Sasha Turner, Sadia Hartman, people who think about bodies as ways of learning and knowing. And it's been really helpful for me to read work by art historians. I'm totally obsessed with the Making and Knowing project that Pamela Smith does at Columbia, experimental archaeology, where scholars use either approximations or actual old tools to try and understand how the experience of working with them might have shaped people's lives. There's so much to draw from to try and understand these topics that I find so interesting. And I'm really, really grateful that both the editors of the book and my advisors here, Elizabeth O'Brien and Alexander White, have been really supportive of this sort of like pastiche of approaches. It's been really helpful.
Those are some great people to think with. Mm-hmm. I love that you mentioned Pablo Gomez. I love his work.
And we, you know, love interdisciplinarity over here. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate that. And speaking of interdisciplinarity, so the field of medical humanities or health humanities is inherently interdisciplinary. So I was wondering, you know, we were kind of cobbling together different definitions of the medical humanities as we interview all of our guests on this podcast. So we were wondering if you could take a stab at kind of what the medical humanities are to you, how you might use them, and what kind of value they bring to you in your work.
I think this is a very hard question.
Sorry.
What is sort of the working definition that you guys have?
Oh my gosh, we've got so many definitions.
Yeah, you just put me on a spot.
But the definition of medical humanities that I use is like, okay, so you start with a very base interdisciplinarity of medicine or health or the body combined with some form of humanities, right? That's really broad and capacious. And that's just like the baseline. That's the baseline definition. But then to me, medical humanities has to also have some sort of engagement with emotion, ethics, or equity. And so like it has to be a kind of active discipline that tells us something deep about who we are as people, as embodied beings, and what we can do with that knowledge. Does that make sense? That's kind of my working definition. I don't think anybody on the show has said it in exactly that way, but that, you know, but they all kind of fit into that in some way. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I think that it's been really helpful for me to think about sewers intersecting with the medical humanities in several ways. I think one is a reminder that medicine and bodies don't only exist in spaces that are legibly medicalized. So not in clinics, not only in hospitals, not only in dissecting rooms, but the traces of things that pass through our bodies as a product of medical encounters are out in the world, sometimes in places we have never even touched, right? Like the middle of a stream or an ocean. And so the influence of medicine on landscapes is something that I think sewers can help us track. I think from the perspective of the extent to which medical humanities can help us understand ethics, for me, thinking about sewers as kind of large-scale civic projects has helped me think about questions about what we owe to each other as neighbors coexisting on a planet, and the ethics of trying to think about how to protect ecosystems for hopefully future generations of people we won't ever meet. And so, those have been some ways that it's been really, really fruitful for me to think about it in that way.
I love that. That was really good.
Yes. Succinct.
Yes. You want to send us on out?
I don't want to, but I guess I will, because this has been such a lovely conversation. Aside from your dissertation, and we know that you have an important talk coming up in the department really soon.
Woo!
What are you working on next? I think you hinted at our last meeting that you were working on another book, but if you could tell us more about that and any other projects you have in the pipeline.
Pipeline. Yeah.
Pipeline. See what I did there?
Pipeline.
Ooh, that's okay. A knee slapper.
Sorry. Okay, go ahead.
No, that was great. Yeah, I am working on another book, I hope. I am working through a revision of the proposal. That book's about fossils, but definitely a similar focus on, relationships between industry and capitalism and infrastructure and landscapes. And I am also writing a currently very bad novel that I hope will be less bad at some point in the future. That is about a UFO convention in the desert of California and family dynamics that splinter under the pressure. So stay tuned for hopefully a version that is good enough to eventually show to someone.
I love you've got fossils, sewers, UFOs, dissection. Those are like all such fascinating topics in themselves. And I'm jealous that you've got, kind of tendrils in all of them. That's so exciting.
I'm sure a fifth project will come about too once you finish taking classes.
In the next couple of years, we'll have like four episodes with Jessica Hester and one on each topic. It'll be great.
I'll hang out with you guys anytime you'd have me.
No, but this was so great. Thank you so much for joining us. That's the end of our questions. And you answered all of them beautifully. And we can't wait to hear more about fatbergs and sewers and sewer stewardship, the hardest phrase to say ever. And
UFOs.
And fossils. Yeah, thanks so much for teaching us. And we'll talk soon.